Good evening, everybody. My name is Hiroshi. I am an alcoholic. Hiro is the name that I chose for myself when I wanted to be less Japanese. And it's really hard to be less Japanese when you're Japanese. So, but we try, don't we? I'm so grateful to be here. I think about the two things that are happening in this building right now. There's us doing what we're doing, folks on the second floor doing what they're doing, and then there's folks that are displaced living here. And there are these three Chinese apocryphal curses. So they might not have actually been curses in the past, but we've come to think of them as these three Chinese curses, and they're so odd. The first one is, may you live in interesting times, and we've been living in interesting times. The second one, so many of us know a lot about, it's, may you come to the attention of the authorities. The third one is, may you get exactly what you want. This is terrifying to me. See, I'm a guy where I've got a sobriety date, thank God, November 12, 2007. And so since that day, thank you that you're applauding for Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsors, my home group. My current sponsor is Johnny H. He founded my home group, the Bellflower Big Book Group, in 1972. He's 94 years old, so it takes a lot of ego and whininess to be able to whine to a 94-year-old with 63 years sober, you know, about the small problems of my day. But on my own power, I'm a whiny baby man. On my own power, I have really low pain tolerance. On my own power, I feel entitled to tell you all of my problems or tell you what I think yours are. On my own power, I just want freedom without responsibility. On my own power, I want to just play all the time with no work. On my own power, I want to drink the way I want to drink. And the problem with drinking the way I want to drink is I end up not drinking the way I want to drink. In fact, I end up drinking in ways that I don't even give permission for. I must have wanted that because I'm doing it again. When I get exactly what I want, my life turns really, really dark. My life gets really, really small. I mean, what I think I want is I'm just like any other American hedonist. I just want to pursue pleasure and avoid pain. And the horrific thing about that, of course, is that the more I pursue pleasure and the more I avoid pain, the more pain becomes like horrifically present, available, embodied. And the more pleasure seems fleeting and just impossible to reach. So that's terrifying. I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I want to welcome everyone who's in their first 30 days and also everyone who's in their last 30 days. And the first time I heard someone say that, I looked around the room because I was like, wait, which ones of us is that? And I felt those horrible like shivers and you know, the hairs on my arm sticking up, because this is my only sobriety date so far. And my former sponsor, I changed sponsors this past March, and prior to that I was sponsored by Bob D in Vegas, and Bob always talks about how, you know, I could be facing in two directions in Alcoholics Anonymous. I could be facing AA or I could be facing away from AA. No matter what, life is gonna kick me in the butt. When life kicks me in the butt, I'm gonna fall. And so far, every time, I've fallen into your arms. The death of my parents, global pandemic, loss of friends, loss of sponsees, loss of sponsors. Always into your arms. There's that meme that goes around in times like this, right? Of where we get to see Mr. Rogers again. Well, again, if you're like old like me, where he's talking about like look for the helpers. We don't have to look for the helpers. look at all the helpers that we have. Like, I love my little my little host committee, and they just take just obscenely good care of the speakers, and just look at all the helpers. Look at all the folks that weren't even named by Lacey, like that are just doing what we do, just showing up early, setting up, taking down. I'm so grateful for those things. So I'm supposed to share in the general what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And so first, what I used to be like, I was made in Japan. And it's really strange because, you know, I was created and born in, you know, the middle of the 1900s. As was this convention, I think about, you know, like 49 years ago, wow, that was when I really needed a drink. Like, needed a drink! And I did not know that was available for me. I did not know that the kind of freedom that I would get by just putting simple ethyl alcohol into my body. And I didn't know that it would combine in this magical way that would just be wonderful, where all of my feeling bad skills would just shut off. I didn't know that there was a shut-off switch for all my feeling bad skills. And all my feeling bad skills include things like, you know, a head that tells me, you know, Hiro, you suck more than anyone's ever sucked before, and a head that tells me that wakes me up at 3 a.m. going, hey, wake up, mother ever, time to worry. A head that tells me, you know, like, this ain't right, and doing the same thing that the Buddhists warn us about, right? Like the problem of desire, the problem of grasping for things that we currently don't have, or the problem of aversion of like the things that we don't. I don't want this here. And like Bob would always tell me, people who argue with reality tend to get sick. And I was sick as a kid. Now, thank God I was really good at pretend. I'm still good at pretend today, but I don't call it play anymore. I call it, you know, anxiety and depression. So we moved to North America when I'm like smaller than a breadbasket, like before the age of one. My father, huge brain on my dad, he got into a PhD program studying organic chemistry in Canada. And my memories of Canada are primal, you know, like white snow people. And he gets his first postdoc in Tucson, Arizona. And so that's when my autobiographical memory comes online, and that's when I realize like I'm different. Like I've got my weird little bowl haircut. I don't have a bridge to my nose yet, and so I got like kids calling me flat face. And they're like, what's going on with your eyes? And they're doing that whole thing. And I am determined to change whatever I can. Like I'm doing the Serenity Prayer without knowing it. I'm trying to change the things I can. What can I change? I can change my linguistic ability. I can change my ability to sound like you, to sound American, and to do the things that my parents were never able to do, like pronounce the difference between THs and S's and R's and L's and get the articles right, you know, like the. And I do it. I do it. By the time I'm done with kindergarten, I've mastered English. And what happens? My father gets a second postdoc, this time in inorganic chemistry, in polymer chemistry. Now, my understanding of that, I'm not a chemist, but I understand that that's a completely different field of chemistry. It's like being an ear, nose, throat doctor and suddenly deciding I'm going to specialize in gynecology. Like, they're all holes, right? So I'll just go do that. So what happens? So we get into this little Pontiac, and we travel across the country, and we end up in 1971 in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Yeah, and I don't know if you know, but like in Tuscaloosees, they don't talk like I talked in Tucson, Arizona. Like all of a sudden, I don't talk right anymore. Like the word "hi" has three syllables. You know, like "hi," and it's not good. And I did not know that at the age of 42, I would be required to either be better at suicide or to surrender to a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, there may be some of you that are historians, and you might be tempted to let me know that the word surrender is not in the first 164 pages, and that is absolutely true. But it tells us in the big book that the first step is for me to concede to my innermost self that I'm an alcoholic. And a concession is a complete letting in. And I can't completely let in unless I let the walls down and the weapons down and just surrender. And I didn't know in first grade that surrender would be such an amazing thing to have had done. done, like seems horrific beforehand, but to have had done, all I know about surrender at the age of 6, 7 is that it just doesn't feel good. Surrender feels like this. It's after school, I'm walking up to the kids, they're posted up on the corner, and they're all, oh, here comes Hiro, let's play war, you play the Japs, and I'm like, oh, great. And I want to fit in, it's like, okay. And I don't know, what's happening, I just know that it doesn't feel good. I mean, it felt good to be included, that part felt good, but it was that like, there's like good news, bad news, always, right? And the bad news was it felt kind of icky, and I wouldn't have the words for it later, like maybe that was just hazing, maybe that was bullying, maybe that was just microaggressions, maybe it was casual racism, I don't know, but all I know is it didn't feel good. And so then what happens is I've learned to fit in there. I'm like a chameleon. I can't fix my bowl haircut. I can't fix the hat. I still don't have a bridge to my nose, but I can sound Southern. I can be a Bubba. And then we move from there to the Inland Empire. We moved to Claremont, where there's like 7 universities. It's so multicultural there. And it turns out that if you're an Asian American kid like me that doesn't grow up around other Asian American kids, those kids have a name for an Asian American like me. They're calling me things like Banana and Twinkie. Yellow on the outside, white on the inside. And I'm like, oh, great, now I'm around people who look like me and I still don't fit in. So I'm pushed by this discomfort. And all of my feeling bad skills, like wondering what you think about me, why aren't you thinking about me, why aren't I included, why am I always chosen last, all that stuff. And I'm pulled by things like, I was called to things like books and play, and I was called to like escape like that. And it wasn't until the age of 12 that I would discover alcohol. And my buddy Dave, he's already 6'4", with an Almond Brother hair, like part in the middle, down to his butt, you know, and he's got these piercing blue wizard eyes way up there at like this high, and I still haven't hit puberty yet. But he's diagnosing me after school in the science fiction book club, because that's how cool I am, that's how I roll. And he's telling me, buddy, you seem anxious. And you know that thing where like you find a name for like everything you experience, and you're like, and oh yeah, we're all alcoholics or members of Al-Anon, so yeah, so you totally understand. But when he said, and he said, I know what'll fix you, and I was intrigued, because like, he had those wizard eyes, man, and he suggested that I meet him the next morning on the north side of campus, on the other side of the bamboo field, and he's going to get me some of what I need. And so I show up early. It's like an AA meeting. I don't know that yet, but it's like an AA. Like, I'm the greeter. There's only 2 of us, but I'm the greeter, right? And he comes and he shows me how to take these drinks really fast. And it's like this. Nobody showed me how to do this. I just instinctively knew that. You know, like that. And that wasn't enough. And then he showed me how to smoke these funny green cigarettes real slow. And my idea before this was like, of a good time, was like memorizing pi for another 10 digits, or trying to figure out what the biggest, prime number is, or sneaking out on a Friday night with my Spock ears to go to the Star Trek convention. And all of a sudden, I'm having a hard time walking, and I can't stop laughing. And I'm all, oh my God, it's just probably more like, oh my God. I can't wait to go to algebra. There's a member of my home group, Greg, who sat behind me in algebra. He's now sober as well. That this thing happens, I become an evangelist for King Alcohol and his little buddies, right? Because it's amazing. And then what happens is I start noticing this thing where I'm wanting to see you feel the way I used to feel, like this. I want some vicarious pleasure in lighting you up. And the next thing I know, 14, 15, kids are getting worried about how I'm drinking. They're like, there's a place called Alcoholics Anonymous. I think you might need to go there. And I do what all of the rest of us alcoholics do, right? Which is to find others who can drink more than I do so I can feel fine about my drinking. And at the age of 16, I'm done. My parents are good, hardworking, immigrant parents. And I'm a firstborn son, and if you know anything about Japanese culture, I experienced it as a burden. I experienced it as a weight. I experienced it as the tyranny of expectation. I didn't know until later that it was hope and it was legacy. And I didn't know that. I just thought that my parents just disapproved of me. Today, my experience today through Alcoholics Anonymous is I think that there are the best metaphor I can come up with is cultural subtitles, right? There's cultural subtitles, there's intergenerational subtitles, there's parental subtitles it's the intention that I can't see. So my parents are all like I'm in fifth grade, and my parents are like telling me, you know, what happened with this B? Everything else is an A. And my buddy, he's getting $1 for each of the A's. And I'm like, what? I can't get a break, not knowing later on that in those subtitles, my parents were saying things like, we love you so much. You've already exceeded our ability linguistically. You've already gone so much further than us. The only thing we know that is going to help you succeed is education. So we're going to ride you. We're going to be on you. And what they didn't know, and I didn't know, is that they were trying to communicate to me in those subtitles that they're proud of me and they love me. And I had no idea. No idea. And they succeeded at their goals of raising me. Like, if you have kids, or maybe you're a kid like me, where your parents were absolutely successful in doing what every single parent wants to do, which is to give you a better life and make it so that you don't have to struggle the way that they struggled. And I gave them the proof that so many of us kids provide our parents of that success. I was completely entitled. I had no idea what they sacrificed, and I didn't care. And so at the age of 16, I'm ready to die. I'm ready to go. I might be able to make it to like 25, maybe to the 27 club, but no, I can't. I'm done. And I have a handful of Valium and a handful of Librium and a bottle of Bacardi 151, and I'm ready to go. Done. No note. But I forgot I was a puker. Now, unlike so many of you that I was always very jealous of, those of you who can, you know, drink, drunk, puke, rinse, repeat, like, AKA rally, I could never do that. I have you know, the Asian flush. I've got natural born anabuse in my body, and so I would do everything I can to avoid taking that drink. And for me, that drink is projectile vomiting, which means I can't. You know, I can't put another drink past my lips for at least another 12 to 36 hours, which is horrible. That's my solution. And so I would do everything I can to avoid that drink, but this was one of the times when it saved my life. And I'm really, really grateful that I passed out on my side as opposed to on my back, because otherwise I would have aspirated on my own vomit a little early, like my favorite, you know, rock and roll stars did at age 27. So I'm super grateful. You think that would send a kid like me to Alcoholics Anonymous? It doesn't. I'm going to speed through the next few decades. Graduate from high school, get into one of the big universities in LA, take 7 years to graduate instead of four. And I'm gifted. And the problem of being gifted in the West is this. I mean, developmental psychologists are fascinated by stuff like this, where we don't like doing things that are hard. Everything should be easy. Anything worth doing should be easy. And the problem with that is then there are people who I know have less natural ability who are far exceeding me. Why? Because they're applying themselves. They're working hard. They're doing the thing that I'm not willing to do. And I have no idea that really it's the stuff that we work hard for that's really worthwhile. I have no idea. But I'm just bewildered. And the other thing, too, is one of my coping skills is just giving up when things are hard. And another coping skill is developmental psychologists are also fascinated by kids like me. Kids who experience bullying know exactly how alienating and how horrific and obscene that feels, and then turn into bullies. And that's me. Not that I got all burly I would do it verbally, because I was always a really good observer of human behavior. I would always be able to figure out like what was the secret that you had, or the thing that your greatest weakness. And even if you were my best friend, if you got scary to me suddenly, like, oh, like I would just impale you with it publicly. And so whenever I give talks in the Inland Empire, like in Claremont or at the Upland Group, I'm always looking for people that I owe an amends to, because I was an equal opportunity bullier, because I was scared of so many people. And so anyway, I graduate from one of the big schools in 7 years. I take I get into a top 25 program in English literature, PhD program in the Midwest. I end up with graduate student writer's block and seasonal affective disorder. And so I take the units that, and the thing is, I'm going to all the classes, I'm doing all the reading, I'm participating. I have this idea that somehow if I've already thought through all the ideas in a paper, that I shouldn't have to write it, not actually realizing that it's the writing that's the work, that's what I'm getting paid with a grade for. And so I take the units that I actually do finish, and I get a full ride in the other big university in LA. That's where I meet my wife, who's sitting over there, Velvet. I'm so grateful she's here with me. Thank you for coming. She's an introvert. She doesn't people a lot. And so this is rare for her to come out like this. And I used to say, just to take a break to talk about my love for her, we meet in 91. And we get together in 92 during, you know, what was then called the LA riots, the civil unrest that was happening then. And we get married in 95, and I don't get sober till 2007. So two things, you know. One is that I can be very exciting. And second, you can figure out the misery math, right, of all the roller coasters that she experienced. And this thing happens where I somehow bring the seasonal affective disorder with me to sunny Southern California, and I still have the graduate student writer's block, and I have a full ride by teaching freshman writing. So I have once again that sense of being a hypocrite, that sense of a double life that Wilson talks about, and I drop out of there, but you know I got a place to live and. And we get married in 95, and gradually I end up defeating the writer's block, and I get into another PhD program, and I'm kicking ass. Because see, the thing is, I for the longest time I didn't think I needed Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't think I needed Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm really, really good at controlling and enjoying my drinking, except for when I'm horribly not. I am generally a periodic until I become a daily drinker, and I'm a binge drinker until, you know, I need it in the morning to take the edge off. And I've always been really good at stopping. I hate stopping. But until the very end, I was really, really good at stopping. I love having had stopped. Having had stopped makes me a cheap date. So what happens in 2007, I'm basically done with all the coursework in a doctoral program. I've completed an experiment, and I just have to write it up. I'm most of the way through a pre-doctoral internship, and I'm having a psychotic episode in the hospital that I'm working in. And in my case, what's happening in that bathroom? I remember this was a day where I'm in the bathroom in the men's room, looking in the mirror, hating the guy, not recognizing the guy in the mirror. And I'm doing the F word mantra, which is like F, 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 F. The DJs in the room would know like how many like beats per minute that is. And it's kind of like Tourette's, but it's rhythmic. But it's, you know. And the reason I'm behaving this way is I'm trying not to be actively psychotic. And those of you who have been actively psychotic know that trying really hard doesn't work at all. And the reason I'm trying not to be actively psychotic is so I could leave that bathroom and go provide psychotherapy to a seven-year-old. And it's notoriously difficult to do play therapy to a child with generalized anxiety disorder if the therapist is more terrified than the child. And it's hard not to be terrified because the shadows keep moving. And I don't go and try and do that because I had just a little bit of clarity to realize that would be harmful. And I go to my bosses, I tell them a little bit of what's going on for me. I tell them I'm having panic attacks at work. I'm sleeping maybe 2 or 3 hours a night, maybe 2 or 3 nights a week, and this has been going on for 3 or 4 months. Maybe I have that sleep deprivation psychosis. And before I can go down further in the iceberg of symptoms, they say, you don't have to tell us anymore. Please go down the hall to human resources. They'll connect you to the employee assistance program. Please see a professional. Please get well. Please don't contact your patients. We'll take care of them. Come back when you're better. Please bring a note. And for the last time, I do that thing where I stop with some assistance on my own, and I get down kind of where I am, what I'm like at baseline now. At baseline, at first, I'm relieved because I don't have those other symptoms. But then what happens that I didn't realize until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous is that someone invites me to a wine tasting. It's like Fred in the back of More About Alcoholism, where it's a beautiful day, a sunny day. All I have to do is not drink or use. All I have to do is just stay on the straight and narrow. All I have to do is get my head down and just go. And someone invites me to a wine tasting. And it's kind of like, what I didn't know that night, I didn't know that that I would take that drink, of course. And then within 30 days, I would be crazy again. And I knew that in the back of my mind, at some point, everything's going to come crashing down. And Velvet, my wife, she confronts me with those dead glass taxidermy eyes. You know the ones. Except sometimes it's like she's part owl, and they go blink, blink, terror, and blink, blink, despair, and blink, blink, contempt. And like, what have you done with my husband? Give me that Visa card and the MS card. We might be done. And I make an SOS phone call, and I call the only person I can think of calling. And I don't call any of you. I knew so many of you. But I don't call you because I'm not an alcoholic yet. The person I call 9:30 on a Friday night picks up on the third ring, and I am like this, Mary. I'm so glad you answered the phone. I don't trust my shrink. I think I need a new shrink. I think I'm bipolar. I think I need some lithium. And she asks me what's going on, and I tell her I have my first surrender. I tell her everything, and I talk, you know, really fast for about 20 minutes, and about all the skeezy acting out I'm doing and all the crap I'm pouring into my body. And I'm not drinking to get drunk anymore. I'm just trying to like shut everything off, but my body's getting drunk and my head won't shut off. And it's telling me what an idiot I am. I can't even drink right. And so I'm done with this confessional. And at the end of it, she says, Hero, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been sober for 22 years. Maybe you need a meeting. And it's like there's a branch 2 inches below my belly button that just goes pop, and I just start sobbing like yuck, 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 like stomach crunches involuntarily, like full on ugly cry, because I knew about AA, I knew that one day at a time meant forever, and so that was terrifying. but the real. But the real reason is that I'm also bewildered. Now, tonight I've been fairly bewildered because of, you know, lack of sleep, but it turns out that the one thing I've learned since COVID is bewilderment when it's not sandwiched, when that horseman is not sandwiched by terror, bewilderment, terror, frustration, despair, bewilderment by itself can actually be truly delightful. I used to pay good money to get bewildered, so. So by itself, but he, in this state, like, it, but there was some hope with the bewilderment, but I didn't understand what happened. She was the one who taught me how to send you to AA. She was the one who taught me to tell you things like, you might not drink right. You might need this place called Alcoholics Anonymous. They know how to stay sober there. I can't help you with that. She told me to tell you, if you go to AA, she would have me hand you the LA meeting directory, because this is in LA, and we still printed those really fat things at that time. And she would have me tell you the difference between a closed and open meeting. An open meeting, anyone can go. Closed meetings are for alcoholics only. She told me to tell you, if you go there, go to listen for similarities, not differences. Go there to identify, not compare. I didn't know that she was teaching me to do exactly what my sponsor that I found the next day taught me to do when we were reading out of the big book. We get to the second page of the sentences in the preface of the fourth edition, and it says, if you have a drinking problem, and my sponsor told me, whenever anyone's talking at an AA meeting, sharing, try to pause in hearing it, but it says, we hope that you may pause in reading one of the 42 personal stories and think, yes, that happened to me, or more important, yes, I felt that, or most important, yes, I believe this program can work for me too. And so I knew what to do. I knew what to do. And the next morning, I go into my first meeting, and I'm on my own power. I'm overeducated beyond my usefulness. On my own power, thinking becomes just a prison. And it's horrific. I'm so analytical. I can tell you all the reasons I suck. I can tell you all the reasons you suck. I can tell you all the reasons why we're all going to suck forever. And cognitive psychotherapists will tell you that's a depressive worldview. And thankfully, what you all told me was, why don't you perform an experiment? You've been trying it your way. You've been drinking, you've been trying to live your life, you've been trying not to drink, and that hasn't been working because you always end up drinking. Why don't you try it our way? Why don't you perform an experiment? And so I started doing this thing, and what happened was I did everything. I just tried to be a good student and tried to show up, and I would try to listen to every single person. Early on I got to hear Teresa F., our spiritual speaker tomorrow morning, and I didn't believe in God, but I heard your stories about God, and I really liked the God that you believed in, but I didn't like the God that I was running away from and that I no longer believed in. And it turns out that I was engaging in something that is part of the history of religion, that any theocratic religion, you'll have an established religion, and then all of a sudden you'll have this period of time where these mystics are trying to access this thing that's beyond the material. They're trying to do this thing that transcends material reality. And how do they do it? There's this Greek word called apophatic theology, and it's all the things that God isn't. And so what would happen is like, well, I don't believe in a God that blah, blah, blah. And my sponsor would be like, I don't believe in that God either. And I'm like, oh, okay. And so there'd be all these attributes of God that I don't want. He's like, well, then don't choose that God. And when Teresa shared, it was right before my fourth step, and this was a beautiful moment because shortly before that, my friend Jason Smith, who had passed away in 2010 with 19 years sober, he pulled me aside and he said, you know, I know you've been having a hard time. You've been having a hard time with the God deal, and let me just break it down to you really simple. Step one is I can't drink right. I can't not drink right. No matter what, my life is unmanageable by me. And step two, I can't fix it alone. And step three, a decision to take the rest of the steps. And immediately I start arguing because I'm good at that. And I say, well, Jason, what about the whole God thing? And he says, no. He was sponsored by my current sponsor, Johnny. And I had heard Johnny when I was about 30 days sober. And I heard him, the only thing I heard him say was that the 12 steps exist to empty me of me so I can automatically fill up with a power that we happen to call God. And I'm like, I want, let me just empty out as much as possible. And Teresa shared about step four and five at our under the bridge meeting, and I knew exactly what to do, which is like dumb down, focus, and just focus on just writing the next thing, and just ask, listen, write. And I would do that, and the first amends I made were to my parents and to my wife, and I got to be the son that they were trying to raise. I got to be that son. My first job, my get well job was because I defended a dissertation at day 24, which is crazy. I only had 9 pages left in that dissertation. I didn't know. It was 9 pages that were impossible. I had to just do some analysis and do it. And all I had to do was ask for help and follow directions, just like an AA. And then I get a job like teaching in a master's program at one of the two universities, the one I just graduated from. And then all of a sudden, my mom's like, she's all, oh, my son is professor at USC, and I'm like, Mom, no, I'm just an adjunct. And my sponsor's all, just let her think, let her say whatever she wants. And I take all these steps and I start sponsoring folks and I start realizing why it is that people were so interested in my welfare. Newcomer, we're like a tribe of vampires, except we're not trying to drain you of blood. We're trying to find, like, watch the light come up in you. And it's that thing where. With a joy that I can't even access in myself, and I see that you having, and I follow some simple direction, and I start pretending like I don't know anything, my favorite step two tool, and I start doing these things that you tell me will work that I know won't, but I do them anyway. And what happens is that I get to be a good son. I get to do all this travel with my parents, and my father gets really sick, and he ends up... Just in the course of 4 months, he gets sick and passes away. But before that, he starts sundowning in the evening. He starts forgetting he knows English. And because I had been going to the Japanese speaking meeting where I did introduce myself as Hiroshi since the very beginning, I can pitch in Japanese for about 10 minutes for as fast as I do in English. And I was able to sit by his side and talk to him the way you told me to talk to him. And the medical word for his condition of not knowing English is anosognosia. A without, just like agnostic, without knowledge or wisdom, but in this case, A without, and gnosia, knowledge or wisdom, just like agnostic, but the nozo is disease process. And so when that person asked me to go for a wine tasting, that I was in the process of anosognosia. I had no idea that I was in a disease process. I had no idea that I was in the grip of a malady that there is no, that no human power can release me from. And my experience today is this. Last night, today, when I don't sleep, I just find myself reading, and I tend to read lots of theology and philosophy, and I found myself coming across, you know, that whole thing of like the difference between belief and faith. Like belief is like, oh yeah, but that guy can take that wheelbarrow and go across the tightrope. That's actually a person. I found this out last night. It's the American version is Charles Blondin, but he was a Frenchman, so like Charles Blondin. And so, like Charles Blondin, he was like an acrobat, and basically in 1854, like a little over a decade after the Washingtonian movement like petered out after having 600,000 people in it, on three separate days he had a little thread going across like this, you know, about this thick, going across the Niagara Falls on the American side. And he would do things like tumble across, and he did a wheelbarrow across. And at one point, he even had his manager. You can go to Wikipedia and look up Charles Blondin, like it's blonding, like you're turning blonde, but without the G. And there's a photo of this guy with a top hat on his back. It's his manager going across. Now, that's one thing. But the thing that I'm terrified of, is exactly what my sobriety brother Larry T is terrified of. We're both terrified that the people that we love in Alcoholics Anonymous will start to think that the solution for alcoholism is normal living. And what that is like, it's like having the faith and actually being carried by AA across the tightrope, across Niagara Falls, and saying, you know what, no, I got this. Let me step off of here. I can do the tightrope on my own. Right? And it's terrifying. And if you stick around, newcomer, if you stick around, you'll get to practice this thing that all social scientists like me know. There's a reputable single subject experimental design. We've all done it. It's called the ABAB design. So once I do all of AA and my life improves, and once I do everything in AA, have a home group, have commitments at all of my meetings, pick up the phone, always looking for two more sponsees, picking up the phone and connecting with my sponsees when they need me, loving my imaginary sponsees who call me sponsor but don't call me, and I'm doing AA, that's design A. And then my life starts getting really good, and I stop doing the morning prayer, and I stop doing the evening review, and I stop going to as many meetings, and I start just living on my own power. And I'm really, really grateful that Tradition 9 says that we don't need any disciplinarians in Alcoholics Anonymous. All we need is great love and great suffering. And the great love is right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've felt it. I've felt it this weekend. We'll continue to feel it this weekend. And the great suffering is me. And the wonderful thing is if I don't drink or die, that I can always suffer, dislike it, and then come back to be with you. Thank you.